And welcome to a Juno Afternoon here on this Thursday afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. Got some colder weather, but sunny weather today. Definitely felt like maybe the first day of winter out there, the official first day. I guess we had snow earlier this year, too. But sunny, highs around 35 degrees for the rest of today. Mostly clear skies tonight, lows around 18 degrees. Friday and Friday night, partly sunny Friday with highs around 33 and lows in the night around 25 degrees. And Saturday getting cloudier with a chance of snow in the morning and a chance of rain in the afternoon for Saturday. And Saturday night through Sunday night, rain is likely with highs around 40 degrees and lows just around 33. A full show today. We've got Randy Wanamaker and Kimberly Naylor here. Kimberly from the City Museum. They're going to be talking about the Saturday reception, the 70th anniversary of the USS Juno sinking. We'll be talking to cast and crew members of Hairspray from JDHS and the Juno Lyric Opera that's opening up this weekend. Also, Juno Wind Ensemble and the Thunder Mountain High School Band are going to be talking about the Saturday dance concert. An Avalanche workshop will be happening Saturday as well, and Kevin Krein will be here to talk about that. And also, Arts Up with Nancy DeCherney to talk about the busy weekend that we've got ahead of us in the arts. First, here's National Native News.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The head of the Assembly of First Nations says Canada is becoming addicted to resources from territories that belong to Aboriginal people. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, he says the exploitation is leading to some dangerous situations.
Sean Atleo is the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. He visited the Nishkandiga First Nation in northwestern Ontario this week to speak at a conference addressing the problems of resource exploitation. It's called a Back to Our Roots gathering, the third of its kind, and brings together regional chiefs, elders, and frontline health workers to address prescription drug abuse and misuse in First Nations communities. Native leaders say that abuse has escalated as a result of increased development, exclusion from resource extraction, and existing third world conditions in the north. Atleo also says the federal government has adopted the classic addict's denial about the consequences of taking resources from First Nations.
It's hurt people. In fact, it's led to death, dying, and great trauma within First Nations, and a great gap of misunderstanding between First Nations and Canada.
Atleo says he supports regional chiefs in their efforts to protect their lands and their treaties, some of which state that the government cannot claim Aboriginal land without consent from the First Nations. He says treaty agreements are for Native people to share the wealth of the lands, not to surrender it. At issue is the so-called Ring of Fire mining area in northern Ontario. Several First Nations are concerned about the lack of consultation and accommodation and what they say are the negative impacts of the mining development, including damage to the lands and the river systems, and altering traditional ways of life. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Lakota people looking for entertainment on the Pine Ridge community now have a new option. As Jim Kent reports, the Village of Kyle has become home to the first movie theater on the South Dakota Reservation.
Angel Reddist has wanted to own a movie theater for as long as she can remember. Her dream came true last Friday when the Noompa Theater opened its doors to 135 patrons. On the theater's two screens were Pitch Perfect and Paranormal Activity 4. Redis says she's happy to offer her people a nice place to spend an evening.
It's a great benefit. Like, we have nothing to do besides going to sporting events. Now we have a movie theater to go to where kids can bring dates and families can come together as a family and enjoy something together. We see a lot of grandmas and grandkids, and we saw mothers and sons come. It's really nice for our community, for the families to be able to do something together.
Funding for the theater came from the South Dakota Office of Economic Development. Angel Reddist is using Facebook as an advertising tool for the Noompa Theater. Besides competitive prices, the theater's concession stand offers everything from soda and popcorn to cold sandwiches and Nathan's hot dogs. If that wasn't enough, says Reddist, it's 90 miles closer than driving to Rapid City to see a movie. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
The National Congress of American Indians welcomes the second term of the Obama administration. The organization says it's a time for advancing the trust relationship between tribal nations and the federal government. NCAI is hosting a teleconference webinar today to provide a review of how the Native vote played a part in national, state, and local elections. The U.S. Supreme Court will not consider a challenge in the historic $3.4 billion Indian Trust settlement. According to the Associated Press, Kimberly Craven's petition for the court to review the settlement was denied late last month. Craven argued it enriched attorneys and lead plaintiffs. Three other people have agreed to dismiss their appeals. The appeals were holding up distribution of funds. The settlement was reached in 2009 after more than a decade-long fight led by the late Eloise Cobell over the federal government's mismanagement of 500,000 individual Indian trust accounts. During this week in 1967, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Public Broadcasting Act. Native public media, like stations and programming, have become an essential source of news and information across Indian country. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Join Trail Mix Saturday, November 10th at Centennial Hall for a celebration of the Oliver Inlet Tram, live music and dancing with the North Country Cajun Club, along with dinner catered by Abby's Kitchen. Enjoy a no-host bar, as well as a silent and outcry auction, where you can bid on more than 100 auction items, from flight scene trips to power tools. All proceeds help support Trail Mix's continuing stewardship of Juneau's world-class trails, including the restoration of the Oliver Inlet Tram in 2013. Join us Saturday, November 10th. Doors open at 6 p.m. Tickets are now on sale at Rainy Day Books, The Jack, Hearthside Books, and at JunoTrails.org.
Well, welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein with you. Randy Wanamaker in the studio with me right now, and also Kimberly Naylor, Kimberly from the City Museum. Kimberly, a really fascinating presentation coming up on Saturday. Tell me a little bit about what's happening all about USS Juno. This is the 70th anniversary of its sinking.
That's right. There were actually three USS Juno ships. The one that sank was the CL-52, and the presentation at the Juno Douglas City Museum is this Saturday, November 10th, from 10:30 to 12:30, and we have Lieutenant Commander Miguel Vasquez is going to be presenting on the history of the USS Juno ships, kind of the naming protocols for the ships and the history, and he will be presenting from 11 to about 11:45. Mm-hmm. And then we have Brian Crowder from Perseverance Theater, and he will be reading from some of the letters that we acquired. He'll be reading those for us and presenting on that.
That's fascinating. Now, Randy, tell me, you're kind of a history buff about the USS Juno. It's something that is you have expertise on. Tell me a little bit about maybe your personal connection with it, or what is it that is fascinating to you about knowing a lot about this ship and about the events surrounding it?
Well, when the USS Juno was named after Juno, the original CL-52, it was named after Juno, the capital of the territory of Alaska. My mother was Rosie the Riveter in Seattle. Although we're a Juno family, she went to Seattle and worked for Boeing's riveting B-17s, and they started a collection of money from school children. They collected dimes from the school children to buy the silverware for the USS Juno. And the ladies in Seattle that were working at Boeing's that came from Southeast Alaska all sent dimes home. My mother told me that story when I was little, and she told me about the sinking of the ship. And so I've been kind of interested in it ever since. And then in 2008, with the decommissioning of the last USS Juno, I met the last survivor of the USS Juno, Glenn Cecil. He passed away about 3 months ago. And he was at the decommissioning ceremony with me, and he thanked me and the community of Juno for sending a representative to honor his shipmates at the decommissioning.
Well, tell me a little, for those who are not familiar and that kind of thing, or just have a fuzzy memory of the history surrounding, especially the sinking at Guadalcanal. Tell us just a little quick, update on the specific event that we'll be commemorating with the 70th anniversary.
Well, the specific event was the USS Juno was in the Naval Battle of Guadalcanal, which is significant because it was the first naval surface ship battle that the United States Navy won in fighting the Japanese. And although they paid a horrendous price in lives and ships. They defeated the Japanese both tactically and strategically.
And, over 600 casualties, yes, just in the USS Juno alone.
Almost 700 men were lost on the USS Juno alone. Mm-hmm. And there were thousands of men that were lost in that battle. But the USS Juno was the single largest loss of life. The battle was famous because it not only did the Juno sink, it was struck by a torpedo during the night fighting where the ships were so close to each other they were firing at point-blank range, Japanese and American ships firing at point-blank range. The Juno took a torpedo, and it was limping away from the battle in the morning because its steering and everything else had been shot up and shot out, and it had been damaged by one torpedo, and they were moving away slowly to retreat away from the battle area. The fighting was still going on, and a second torpedo hit it in the same place. It exploded and sank in less than 20 seconds with about nearly 600 people going down with the ship. 100 and some went into the water. They know because people can remember who they saw that survived it. But those people were left in the water for 8 days because nobody realized there were any survivors. Glenn Cecil, who was one of the survivors, had just been transported from the Juno to the San Francisco in order to help with casualties there. He was a Navy medical person, a corpsman, and he was helping wounded on the deck of the San Francisco, which had massive casualties, and he was watching in the direction of the Juno when it took the second torpedo. He said it went up with a horrendous explosion and went down so fast that they believed no one could have survived. But the 100 and some did survive in the water, and when they found out about 8 days later there were survivors, they sent help, and when they got there were only 10 left in the water. All the rest had died of exposure, their wounds, thirst, and shark attacks. And those 10 remembered the names of who they saw.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously a horrific battle in general, horrific circumstances. And then, of course, the human interest story, which became one of the most famous incidents, was the five Sullivan brothers who were on board as well.
Yes, and there were the five Sullivan brothers, and there were two other sets of brothers. One was named Cox. There were, I've forgotten now if the Coxes had two brothers or three brothers on that ship. There was another family that had two brothers. So there were three sets of brothers where they lost every single one of them.
And it became this policy then in the U.S. Navy to not allow brothers to then serve on the same ships after that, right? Isn't that
That's
sort
correct.
Of because
they,
of
they
this?
They would not allow it anymore.
Yeah.
It was just too much loss for any one family. The loss of the Sullivans was the single largest loss to a family in American wartime history.
The one piece of misinformation I continue to hear from maybe younger people who've heard this story is they think the Sullivan brothers were from Juno. They were actually from Iowa.
Yes, Waterloo, Iowa.
Yeah, but I've heard that off and on through the years. Oh, the Sullivan brothers from Juno. It's like, no, they served on the USS Juno, but they were from Iowa. But an incredibly tragic part of the story. And then there was a ship named the Sullivans that was then commissioned, yeah.
Yes, there was a destroyer that was named the Sullivans after the sinking of the Juno. The Sullivan brothers were from Waterloo, Iowa, but also in looking at the records really carefully, the Navy let us know that there was no one from Juno who was serving on the ship. It just happened to be named after the town, no one from Juno was serving on the ship at the time that it was sunk.
But it's become this natural place because of the naming for us to take that responsibility and remember the people who served in that ship and remember the ship and remember the history and also have ceremonies. We also, of course, have the plaque about the USS Juno here in town.
Yes. And we're going to have that formal event on Tuesday after the Saturday presentations with the Meeker letters at the City Museum and the presentation about the ships on Tuesday from 12:15 to 12:45. We're going to have a formal ceremony down at the dock near the Mount Roberts Tram where the memorial is. We'll raise the flag to the national anthem. We'll have an invocation by a chaplain. We'll have an explanation of the history of the memorial plaque and some comments from the Navy about the loss of the crew. We're going to be acknowledging the loss of the crew and the preservation of our freedom. And then a few remarks by me representing the Assembly, and then Taps will be played by Dave Hurlbut, a local bugler, and we'll place wreaths during the taps. And then we'll have the benediction, and then the playing of Eternal Father, the Navy hymn, and we'll go back.
And when does that start on Tuesday?
12:15 to 12:45 down at the dock.
Okay. Kimberly, tell me a little bit about these letters. You've just recently acquired these letters, which sound fascinating.
Yeah. They were donated to us from Raymond and Mary Testa. Her mother, Wilhelmfred Bone, she was in correspondence with one of the sailors that was on the USS Juno. William G. Meeker Jr. was a sailor, and he wrote to Wilhelmfred Bone during the time that he was on service on the Juno, and he wrote these beautiful letters, and we acquired them, and we're going to have them on display during the reception. They're beautifully written. It's a gorgeous love story between the two, and they grew up together in New Jersey.
And also gives people an idea of the life that was being led by these sailors as well.
Absolutely.
Well as expressing, you know, personal feelings about each other. He was describing a lot about what was going on.
Absolutely. He was describing a lot about what it was like to be a sailor on the ship. And it starts out, and he's very excited about being in the Navy and being on the ship. And it kind of moves into, you know, he starts to miss home and he starts to miss her. Mm-hmm. And it'll be a beautiful presentation. And we'll be performing. Brian Crowder with the Perseverance Theater will be reading them.
Great. Well, it all starts at 10:30 a.m. It's Saturday. It's at the City Museum. Once again, it's the 70th anniversary of the sinking of the USS Juno. Then there'll be a formal memorial service, as Randy was just saying, on Tuesday at 12:15. Is that right?
12:15
down by the tram and by the harbor there by the tram. Thanks both for coming in and letting us know about this event that's acknowledging this slice of World War II history that Juno takes responsibility for because of the naming of the ship. So thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thank you very much for having us.
Okay. Sounds like fun right there. A little bit of a snippet of the Broadway cast doing Hairspray. And we've got a couple of folks in here right now, John Clow and Scarlett Adam from JDHS and Juno Lyric Opera, involved in the JDHS Juno Lyric Opera cooperative cool presentation of Hairspray.
Very cool.
Welcome, you guys.
Good to see you, Andy.
Yeah, well, tell me, John, I'll just tell me about Hairspray and maybe the idea about doing this show to start with.
Well, first of all, this is, as you pointed out, it's a collaboration between Juno Lyric Opera and Juno Douglas High School, and it's sort of a famous first in that regard. And we're real excited about it because, quite frankly, this is a truly big Broadway-style show with lots of singing, a whole lot of dancing, great sets, great, fantastic costumes from a professional costume outfit down in Kansas City. And it's a kind of show that, quite frankly, is big enough that Juno Lyric Opera couldn't have done it on its own, and JDHS couldn't have done on its own. So we got together and we formed a collaboration, and
trying to pick a big musical come first, or did the idea of let's collaborate and find a big musical come first?
No, this was driven by the musical. Lyric Opera came up with the idea. We really wanted to do Hairspray, but we knew we need a lot of young members in the cast, and we knew it was the type of event that, like I said, cried out for collaboration. And at first we tried to work it out with Thunder Mountain High School, and we had some scheduling problems and other issues there, and at one point it looked like it wasn't going to happen. But then JDHS stepped up to the plate, and it's just taken off since then.
Well, Scarlett, tell me about your role in this. And
well, I just run around behind John and pick up the pieces and pat him on the back.
Well, I'm sure. As we saw in the hallway earlier, he's knocking stuff over all the time.
Oh, yeah.
That's true.
But we love him. We'll keep him anyway.
Well, tell me about some of the challenges of doing this particular production.
Well, when we started talking about this 2 years ago with Hal Ryder, our director, one of the main things that drew us to the show was, first of all, it's just a really great show, and it has a wonderful message. But we wanted to do something where JLO could step outside of our box. Everyone thinks opera. Oh! But we wanted the opportunity to draw from our regulars who mm-hmm. perform with JLO, but also the rest of the community. We wanted people from all over the community to come together and enjoy the production. And so that's what really brought us to this show.
All right. So give people a little bit of a taste of the storyline of Hairspray. If they haven't seen the movie or haven't seen the Broadway production or aren't that familiar with it, just a little bit about the storyline.
Well, you know, one thing people don't know, even the ones that have seen the movie, it's actually based on a true story.
Right.
This is set back in the early 1960s. And back in Baltimore, there was a young guy named Buddy Dean who had his own dance program that was actually doing quite well. And because of the rules of the day, it was whites and whites only on his show, except for one day a month when they had Negro Day. And that was the only day African Americans were allowed on the show. And Buddy Dean tried to integrate the show. He really tried to take a step forward, and he got fired for it by the station. And the original writers of the Hairspray movie took that story and sort of set it back in that time period and drew this wonderful, fun musical comedy, but with a great message about the importance of tolerance and diversity and just acceptance in this society, and then wrote a whole bunch of really fun songs and dances with it, and off it went.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it's a great, the John Waters version especially, great movie.
Yes,
exactly.
Fantastic. Launched Ricky Lake's career and was a musical in an era when who does musicals in movies, you know? And so that was an exciting thing. So why did you think that this was a good pick, especially for Juno?
We didn't.
Okay.
We were terrified because, you know, it's so big and there's so much dancing in it. And it was like, holy cow, what have we done? But I was just talking with John a little while ago, and over the 2 years of putting it all together, it has really come together. The principal cast, they're brilliant. And the chorus, they're fabulous. And they are dancing and singing, and they look great. It's so much fun. Every night I stand there and clap and cry and jump up and down, and I'm so proud of them all.
Other thing about it, I think that did make it sort of fit for Juno, that's been close to my heart from the start, is we are such a diverse community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Hairspray is set in the 60s, and it's primarily about African Americans and segregation and the amazing challenges that they were facing back then. But the whole challenges of diversity and tolerance or acceptance are just as important in this year here in Juno, you know, 70 years later, or excuse me, 50 years later. And so the message, that underlying message is there. And what I love about our cast is the cast is Juno. It's a really diverse cast. Mm-hmm. We've got older people, younger people, all sorts of ethnic backgrounds. It's Juno. And that makes me feel really good about how we're putting it on.
So what was the most difficult casting decision? What were some of the most
persuading young men to dance?
Yes, yeah.
And they have done such a good job.
That's
of it.
An interesting part of it, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's been like pulling teeth to get the boys to get on stage, to get them in there. And I think once they did, they've had a really great time.
If any young guy can just figure out the power of dance,
yes,
it's a mighty weapon.
Oh, you watch Andre Bunton on stage, and whoo!
Andre is just absolutely top notch. And you know this chorus, you know, they've worked so hard. We've actually had there's so much dancing in Hairspray. If you love musicals with dancing, you've got to come see the show. There's so much dancing. There's two full time choreographers we had working with us. Both Becky Engstrom and Janice Hurley have been working on the show for over a year. And been working with these younger people since this summer on. Mm-hmm. And, boy, the results show. There's just fabulous dancing out there. There really is.
Now, what about – I'm going to ask the big question. What about casting for the mother? The role of Divine or John Travolta, if you're familiar with the newer movie.
They are nothing compared to the fellow we got on our stage.
Okay. Are we revealing who it is? Or?
Well, it's been in the Empire,
okay.
So I think we
can say. We're safe, yeah.
You know, traditionally, the role of the mother has always been played by a man, and we were going to stick with that right from the start. And we wanted to look for somebody who you would never expect to be up there in a musical comedy dancing away in a dress, and it's David Miller, probably Juno's one of Juno's leading operatic voices forever, and he's absolutely fantastic in the role, and he looks really good in red.
Good
he's
in a house coat.
Looks
good in a house coat. That's the thing.
Nobody does support hose like David.
Do you have to teach him how to iron?
It came naturally to him.
Very good. All right. Well, tell us some of the details about opening night and how people get tickets and all that stuff.
Well, we're actually already in our second weekend, there's only three shows left.
It's
this Friday at 7, this Saturday at 7, and Sunday at 2 o'clock, and tickets are on sale online at JunoOpera.org, or you can get them at the Jack, Rainy Day Books, Hearthside Books, or, of course, you can come up to the door itself and get them. We encourage you to buy your tickets in advance just because it makes getting in a lot easier. We've been having really excellent crowds the first weekend. Best crowds we've had for a Juno Lyric Opera show pretty much in the 12 years I've been doing stuff with them, and we're expecting crowds just as good or even bigger this weekend.
And what's the crowd reaction? Is there dancing in the aisles? Is there shouting?
We've had standing ovations every night. Everybody is just very they all seem to be having a great time, and I see people leaving with huge smiles and sort of dancing up the aisles, and I know if they're like me, they're humming the songs all night long.
I mean, if you can't have fun watching Hairspray, you can't have fun. I mean, come
true.
On, right? It's
very
Hairspray.
True.
All right, so it's Hairspray. It's happening. The last three performances happening this weekend, and it's at JDHS.
Yes.
And there you go. It's Hairspray, and John Clow and Scarlett Adam. Thanks so much for coming in.
If you don't see it, you're going to regret it. This is a hit, guys.
This is a big one. Go see it, Hairspray.
Be denied. But what good's a man's world without a woman by his side? And so I will wait until that moment you decide that I'm your man and you're my girl, that I'm the sea and you're the pearl. It takes two, baby, it takes two. King ain't a king without the power behind the throne. A prince is a pauper, babe.
A little taste of Hairspray there. It's happening this weekend, the last three performances. Sounds like a great performance. Go get it. Well, another performance happening is a Juno Wind Ensemble, the Thunder Mountain High School Band. And with me right now is the director of the performance coming up, Mike Busey. Mike, thanks for coming.
Well, thank you, Eddie.
And tell me about, first of all, it's a Saturday dance concert. Now that's what it's being billed as, a dance concert. How does that figure in?
Well, the Thunder Mountain Auditorium may not make a great dance floor when all the stands are set up, so it's more in your head than anywhere else. We originally actually had wanted to have it as a music that's written for band in either a dance style or actually a dance music, and then have dancers come perform. We're going to have some ballet and some tango and things like this. Unfortunately, the size of the stage wouldn't allow us to do what we really wanted to do. So it's just going to have to be imagination and dance music played by a band.
How many numbers do you have kind of lined up?
The Wind Ensemble is going to play, I'm just counting them here, four different pieces. And then we'll play two pieces together with the Thunder Mountain Band.
Okay.
And then they'll play three or four pieces themselves.
And then the wind ensemble, what are the instruments that are typically represented in the wind ensemble?
Well, you know, a wind ensemble, a concert band, the difference between a concert band like a lot of people played in high school, college, something like that, would tend to be that you would have maybe you'd have more than one person playing a part. So you may have three trombones playing in the third trombone part or something. Wind ensemble, it's just pared down, and it's more sophisticated, you might say.
And so what instruments are playing in the one that you're directing?
The typical band instruments, flute, clarinet, saxophones, trumpets, horn, tubas, percussion, but no strings.
So there is percussion.
There's a lot of percussion.
So okay.
Yes.
All right. So so it's got that bass feel to it. It's got that beat that allows for a dance kind of thing to happen, right? Yeah.
It does. It does. You know, what was interesting for me is I've never been able personally. I've just never tuned in to dance really well. I love to play in bands that play dance music. I love to watch people dancing, but it's never resonated so much with me. And then, mm-hmm. and I guess part of me, I think, wanted to explore a little bit in the genre of dance music that was written for dance or in a dance style, inspired by dance. You know, it's a mix of all of that. What I found is that it really doesn't have, dance can happen on so many different levels. And I was thinking, it'll have a beat, it'd be fun, bounce, it'd be great like this. And I was thinking the nasty weather of the fall, it'd be nice to have an upbeat kind
sure,
of concert.
Yeah.
And what I've kind of come away from it after we've been rehearsing for the last couple of months is how you with dance that there's so many different levels, mental, emotional, I'd say spiritual, communal levels that happen. When people come together in that kind of an arts activity, and so it's been eye opening and really really pleasurable playing with this in really great group of Juno musicians, this dance music and opening up I think some really great experiences in the genre of dance.
Where do you find – where are the musicians? What kind of walks of life do the musicians come from?
Oh, it's the usual culprits, a lot of them, that you find in the symphony. And then we've got a few high school students that play with us. It's mostly adults in the Juno Wind Ensemble that have played in college. Some of them have music degrees. A number of them actually have music degrees. They're teachers in town here, doctors, lawyers, and the whole sort
sure.
of lot.
Yeah. So. I mean, it's fascinating to – I think that it's an interesting thing to be good enough to really play effectively in these ensembles. You have to dedicate – you have to, especially in your younger life, you have to have dedicated a lot of hours to music. And I'm mm-hmm. sure that at some point people even thought, well, that might be their career. But then, life happens and you get other careers, but you still want to stay connected to that music.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think that that would be the story. I mean, for myself, I direct – I teach at Floyd Dryden in the middle school in the band program, and so I've been able to, after many years doing other things, I'm very happy to be in music full time. But that certainly is not the case. And even when I wasn't teaching music, I've always stayed involved with it. And I think that's the case probably with most of these folks. Some people have been away a bit, and then they may have come back. I think for the most part, people find a way to play.
Yeah, find a way to get back to that. It's got to be a love at a certain point. Yeah. I mean, it starts off with your mom making you practice, right? And then it turns into a love. I never got past that part, so I don't play anything. But all right, well, anyway, it's the Juno Wind Ensemble, and Mike Busey, the director of it. It's a Saturday dance concert. How can folks get tickets and what time and all that stuff?
There's no tickets. It's
okay.
A free concert.
Okay.
Open to the public in Thunder Mountain. First come, first serve. For seats, we will be taking donations to cover some costs.
Great.
for music and anything that we make beyond our basic costs that we need to cover advertising and whatnot. We plan on donating to the Gaston Apartments.
Or the
Survivors,
Cross
something to that cause there.
That's a great cause. Yeah, so many people displaced by that. So it's really nice to hear of all the different people who are dedicating time and energy and just putting a little bit that they can towards that really valuable cause. What time is the concert?
3:00, 3 in the afternoon Saturday.
Okay, 3 in the afternoon.
It should last. I think with Thunder Mountain and all of it, I would plan a couple hours all.
Great.
So
a couple hours of wonderful dance type music, however you might define that, at Thunder Mountain happening this Saturday. Thanks so much, Mike, for coming in. Let us know about it.
Thank you.
Okay.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 8th of November, 2012. It was on this day, 1864, Abraham Lincoln was elected to his second term as President of the United States, an election held in the middle of a civil war. The Confederate Army had recently gotten so close to Washington that Lincoln himself was able to watch a battle standing on top of a parapet with field glasses. On the 30th of July that year, 4,000 Union soldiers were killed in a disastrous attempt to invade Petersburg, Virginia. Lincoln knew he was going to have to call for another draft. The Army needed a 500,000 more soldiers. There was an enormous war debt. And at the end of August, Lincoln wrote a memo to his cabinet that said, "It seems exceedingly probable that this administration will not be reelected." The Democratic Party was running on a platform of ending the war. But then news arrived in early September that the Union Army had captured Atlanta and Mobile. And suddenly the Democratic Party looked like the party of surrender while Union forces were winning the war. And Abraham Lincoln carried every state except New Jersey, Delaware, and Kentucky. It's the birthday of Dorothy Day, born in Brooklyn, 1897, one of the founders of the Catholic worker movement, workers who lived in voluntary poverty and spent their lives in service to others. Her autobiography, The Long Loneliness, came out in 1952. And it's the birthday of the woman who said, "In a weak moment, I have written a book," Margaret Mitchell, born 1900. And the book, of course, was Gone with the Wind, one of the best-selling novels of all time. When she was 20, she fell off a horse. She got very badly injured, kept re-injuring herself. And a few years later, she had to quit her job as a newspaper reporter and stay in bed. And her husband brought her piles of books from the library to keep her entertained, and then one day came home with a Remington typewriter so she could write her own. She decided to write about what she knew, and so she wrote about Southern belles and Civil War veterans. Kept the book a secret until an editor from Macmillan was in town looking around for manuscripts. And finally, though she said the book was lousy and she was ashamed of it, she brought him piles of manuscript about 5 feet high. It took a lot of cutting, but it was published in 1936, an immediate sensation in the midst of the Great Depression. A book that begins, "Scarlett O'Hara was not beautiful, but men seldom realized it when caught by her charm." Here's a poem for today by Faith Sheeran entitled Tara. I grew up watching Gone with the Wind with my grandmothers rehearsing for my life as Scarlett or Melanie. On the bright steps of my southern childhood, I practiced pinching my cheeks, holding my breath, while someone else tied my corsets. I could make a dress out of curtains. I could deliver a baby while outside Atlanta burned. When the wagon took me home to Tara, I would save the plantation by murder or marriage, my hat tied beneath my chin in a cheerful bow. Like Melanie, I would forgive anything, befriend prostitutes, donate my wedding ring to the soldiers. Someone would kiss me in a field where cotton no longer bloomed. I would want whatever I could not have. I would die trying to have another child. My husband would never recover from loving me, my shape on that marble staircase, too restless for an afternoon nap. Tara, a poem by Faith Sheeran from Moving the Piano, published by Stephen F. Austin University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, you can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's poetry app. Available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vedder. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, providing services for identification, evaluation, and rehabilitation for individuals with hearing difficulties. Located in the Jordan Creek Center. Information at 789-6780.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon here. Got sunny skies happening. Well, I guess there's not going to be too much sun as the sun's starting to set, but clear skies happening for the rest of today. Mostly clear skies tonight, partly sunny tomorrow, and then tomorrow night, chance of snow. And snow is why the next two gentlemen are here in the studio with me right now, which is, thanks so much for coming in, you guys. It's Kevin Crienden here and Ed Shanley. And Ed and Kevin, you guys are helping out with the Southeast Alaska Snow and Avalanche Workshop that's coming up here at the Jack.
Yeah, Saturday.
Yeah, so just tell me, we were talking a little bit about your kind of various positions that you guys have, but you both work with Alaska Powder Descents.
Yes.
But you serve on the board of directors of the Avalanche.
The Southeast Alaska Avalanche Center.
Right. Yeah. And then you've got a whole bunch of roles, right, Ed?
Oh, a couple different things going on. But, yeah, I'm involved with the Avalanche program at ALNP. So Mike Janes, who's the head Avalanche forecaster, will be one of the guys who will be giving a short presentation at the meetings,
yeah,
and right, conferences or –
Yeah, tell
the
me
workshops,
how these. Tell
yes.
me how these go. Tell me how the workshops usually go. Is this kind of an all day thing, or how's it?
Well, it actually starts in the evening, so
okay,
it'll start at 5:30 and go through 9:30, and basically just presentations by real experts in the field. I mean, it's great, the people who are talking. Dale Atkins is here, who's the president of the American Avalanche Association, and has been doing work in the field for years and years and years, and it's just really knowledgeable guy. And Kent Sheeler, who a lot of people know from Juno, who went to school here at UAS and then is now the lead guide for Teton Gravity Research. And he'll be talking about avalanche evaluation and risk management for filmmaking. So people who are interested in that should definitely go. And
yeah, a great little gathering of minds, I guess you could say. It's great that Dale could come up here for the workshops. He's definitely he's been a really strong influence within the avalanche community in North America for quite some time. So a lot of the tickets to get in are just going towards bringing these people in the know,
yeah,
in the Juno for the workshops.
And I think these workshops and just what you're saying, people in the know, it seems like a lot more people are getting in the know about avalanches. You know, it just seems like avalanche awareness and avalanche safety has become such a higher profile thing with people who are outdoors a lot. Do you find that as well?
I think so, definitely. And I think we're lucky just living in Juno that we have this amazing resource here in Juno. There's just a number of people that have really been working with avalanches and within the snow science community for quite some time here in town. So I think this should be a good gathering of minds and just a good excuse for all the backcountry enthusiasts. And it seems like the general backcountry community in Juneau is just getting stronger and stronger every year. So I think this should just be a good excuse for everyone to get together and start thinking about snow.
Yeah. And yeah, as you mentioned, there's a backcountry community. Are there common misperceptions among that community, though, about avalanche and avalanche safety that you find?
Well, I'm not sure if there are actual misconceptions, but I think that most people understand that avalanches pose a serious hazard in the backcountry. But one of the things that's happened over the last, I think, 10 years or so is that the equipment that allows you to get into the backcountry has gotten so much better. And it's so easy to get out into terrain where outside of resorts where avalanches are really an issue. And so
some of the terrain's less well known. It's not being tested all the time. It's not necessarily may look safe, but may not be safe. All that kind of stuff starts getting
exactly
into play. Yeah.
And so education is a little, I think a lot of people know that they should learn more. But, I mean, opportunities are a little bit hard to come by. And this is, you know, one of those times where you can really learn more in a really efficient way about
Ed, when you go out and guide and are out there, what are some of the basic steps that you take to sort of do that first groundwork on finding out if an area is avalanche safe or not?
Well, I think it's really more of a process that I start. I mean, even this time of year, just sort of looking at what the snow has been doing and looking at the forecast and what the weather was like when the snow was coming in. And just once you get out in the field, then you're going from looking at forecast, trying to think about what the snow might be like, to looking at how the new snow is bonding to the older snow, any weird layers that avalanche might slide on. So it definitely it gets very complex. You know, it's definitely a science for sure. And I think this will be a good gathering of people because it's one of those things that I think you forget a little bit about in the summertime. So it's nice to start thinking snow again and thinking about what exactly you should be looking for when you're going out into the backcountry. What would make a safe and fun outing?
Yeah, and safe and fun. I mean, that's what it's all about. It's like challenging yourself and doing that, but doing it in a way that's safe and fun. But it is interesting because as people go into the backcountry, I mean, a big part of that is, you know, stepping it up, next challenge, you know, higher risk. So there's a bit of an element there of the higher risk means, okay, now conditions are going to be a little riskier, obviously.
Right. I mean, there's definitely a fine line, and there's a lot of gray area at times when dealing with avalanches where there might be some issues to worry about, and how much of a concern is that? It's hard to say exactly whether or not this slope will avalanche or not. So it's one of those things. It's always best to err on the side of caution, but knowing where that gray area is and having your own personal level of risk too. I mean, you have to decide for yourself how much you're willing to risk when you're going out into a place like that.
I was going to say, I think too that people want more challenging terrain, but they don't necessarily want to go out on days where there's more instability, right? And so the really key thing to knowing more is being able to pick days where the snow is more reliably stable to go and do things that are more challenging and, you know, get on really steep, big things, but do it in a way that makes sense rather than kind of randomly going out and rolling the dice and seeing what happens.
Where's your main education effort? Is it with the end user, the person that's just a skier, a snowboarder, or is it with operators? I would think with more and more people, I mean, TGR Films, right? Awesome films. All these people see these films. I want to go do that. So there's all these people who are now wanting to go do that. More pressure on tour operators to go out maybe in marginal conditions or go a little bit further out because people are challenging them to do that. So is that a fair assessment of some of the pressures that are happening, and are those the people you're trying to educate? Or are you trying to reach both? Or
well, I think both. I mean, one of the things that we said in organizing this workshop was that we wanted it to be helpful for people in the general public who just want to have some more information, but also helpful for professionals and a chance for professionals to get together and share information.
So it's really not just Snow 101 because professionals are like, yeah, we know this stuff. So it's trying to hit really hardcore guys who will learn something and then also be something that's also useful for people just out in the field. Huh?
Exactly. Yeah.
Sort of a combination of both. All the presentations are only 20 minutes. So they're stacked. There'll be breaks in between. Some of their 20-minute presentations might be getting a little bit more technical for people that have a little bit more background, have taken a couple avalanche classes. And some of the presentations are going to be more geared towards sort of the layman, just people that are out there wanting to go skiing and snowboarding or snowmobiling out in the backcountry around here.
Just so they kind of know, oh, this seems like that situation that I was hearing about at the workshop. This might not be too good. Or when they're digging in, they're and trying to figure out layers and stuff like that, all those kinds of things. Yeah,
exactly. And some of it, too. I mean, Brian Davies, who is the head of Ski Patrol at Eagle Crest, will be giving a presentation. And it's just nice to know, and people find it interesting, I think, or I'd hope they'd find it interesting to see what Ski Patrol does before the mountain opens, right? When you're standing at the bottom waiting for the mountain to open, you're like, what are they doing up there?
And so why isn't the Brian mountain
will be
open?
Talking
Come
about
on.
That a bit. Yeah.
right, exactly. All right, well, and you wanted to also just make sure everyone knows it's a pay-as-you-can, so it's come one, come all. And is there a suggested kind of donation for getting this thing together? I mean, this isn't free to put something like this together.
Well, there is a raffle aspect of it. So there, I mean, a lot of companies have donated equipment to be raffled, and so raffle tickets, there is a price for those, and it's a suggested price of $20 for a raffle ticket, but they'll definitely be worth it. One of the things that we're giving away is a free seat on a heli skiing trip.
There you go.
You have to buy another seat, but
It's
still a great deal for that. And then Smith Optics has donated some goggles, and Aurora Project, of course, has donated things, and there are T-shirts and things. So there will be a lot of things that's possible to win.
Good, always good to have the swag. Always good to have the swag. All right, so it's all happening. Saturday starts at 5 o'clock, or the doors open at 5 o'clock. Presentations start at 5:30. It's all happening over at the Jack right here on Egan Drive, and it is happening this Saturday. Kevin and Ed, thanks so much for coming in. You got one more thing?
There is one more thing.
Okay.
So actually the Gold Town had scheduled at the same time the new Matchstick movie, but they moved that till Monday night, and so
okay,
Colette wanted me to mention that. That
very
that,
good.
The Matchstick film, the new one for this year. What is it called? Superheroes of Stoke.
Yes.
This week at the Nickelodeon, I've heard it's awesome. So okay. Everybody should make sure they go see that.
So that's happening Monday. If you heard that was Saturday, make your stop be over at the Avalanche Workshop instead and learn a little bit about how to stay stoked. And then go see Superheroes of Stoke Monday at the Gold Town. Thanks, you guys, for coming in. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
All
yeah,
right.
Thanks.
Rocky Mountain Way, and if you're interested in those mountains, make sure you head to the Snow and Avalanche Workshop over at the Jack Saturday night. Doors open at 5. Speaking of the Jack, look who's in the studio with me now. It's the operator of the Jack herself from the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. It's Nancy DeTourney. Art's up. And so what's going on in arts?
Oh, goodness sakes.
It just seems like every weekend it just is, gets busier and busier.
I know.
What is with these artists and their cultural events?
They're so busy.
So let's just go through it. Let's start
Well, you know, you could just slow it all down and become an amateur radio operator. There's a series that's starting this evening at 7.
You have a soft spot in your heart for the amateur radio operators, don't you?
Well, you know.
Your father was a ham.
He was a ham in more ways than one. But anyway, they are teaching all that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
and
very cool.
Yeah,
our own
cool.
Pat Moore is mm-hmm. one of the members of yep. that here, a Juno yep. Afternoon host.
So you can get, that's out at the NOAA building on Mendenhall Loop Road tonight at 7, and it goes through the week.
All right.
Macbeth.
You got Macbeth.
Got
to see this, right?
Mm-hmm. This is a must-see.
Must-see this.
We have a couple more weekends, but again, we'll have people who will not get there because it's a tiny little theater.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Friday we have...
And that's at McFeeters Hall, the yep. new McFeeters Hall, and mm-hmm. that's Theater in the Rough. Okay.
Yep. Friday, there's the second Friday teen hip-hop class at the Canvas at 4. We also have Hairspray.
Yes, and we just talked to two members of the Hairspray crew and cast, and mm-hmm. That's exciting stuff.
I
heard
you know,
the first weekend was fantastic, and they have only three performances left, so that's another one. You got to see
one,
it.
Another one. Get in there. Get it while you can.
Yes.
So, also, this week we have a whole bunch of very exciting things. I guess it's just one gentleman here at UAS. The Human Caribou Relations from a First Nation Perspective.
And I've seen beautiful photos of this, just amazing mm-hmm. gorgeous photos that I'm sure will be part of this talk as well. Yeah,
he's here for a while, or at least through the weekend. And the evening at Egan is this gentleman's making a presentation. It's free, of course. It's at 7 o'clock, opening night for Oklahoma.
Yes,
there you go.
Where the winds come sweeping off the plains.
Yeah, in your little Surrey. So you've got Macbeth, Oklahoma, and Hairspray. To get to.
That is just a 1-2
it's
punch
amazing.
Right there.
Ooh,
yeah.
3-4.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, at 8 p.m., we have Poetic License with Kate Laster. This is something that the Canvas and Morally Impoverished are doing. And that's at the Canvas, as I said. Donations are accepted. So there you go.
Great.
Saturday at the Canvas is running a whole bunch of really fun classes that you might want to just go online and check out. And then just go take some. It starts Saturday morning at 10 a.m. with Modern Masters. There's also a writing workshop at 10 o'clock. And also out at the airport shopping mall, it is the second Saturday, Farmers and Crafters Market. And I think that runs all afternoon. At 10:30 in the morning, the City Museum. Now, didn't we decide that that's just too long to say that?
The CM.
So what you can
CM.
See
now,
at
listen,
the CM.
I'll stop you right now because the first 15 minutes of the show was all about it. It's
okay,
the 70th
so it
anniversary
is.
Of the mm-hmm. sinking of the USS Juno. It's going to be a fantastic presentation.
So CM.
At the CM.
Mm-hmm.
Over at
okay, very good.
See you at the CM.
Exactly. So now there's also on Saturday from 11 until midnight, they're having a movie marathon at Rockwell to benefit all the Gastineau folks that lost their homes in the Gastineau apartment fire. I don't know what movies they're showing. I couldn't find that out.
A whole bunch of stuff, but I heard now it's starting at 11 a.m.,
mm-hmm.
right?
And going
yes.
until midnight.
Going on and on and on.
This is a marathon.
Yes,
okay,
and it's going to benefit the Red Cross.
You can bring things there, non-perishables, all that sort of stuff. So if you've been worrying about what those folks are doing, this is a way to help. At 1 p.m., do your kids like to play with Legos? It is the Junior League First Lego League.
There's a problem.
There's a serious issue. Yes. But out at the Nugget Mall in the public room, you can go out and sign them up to be part of the First Lego League for juniors. So there you have it.
I get to MC the Lego League thing every year. It is such a blast.
It is
so fun. Every kid has such a great time.
And then there's GeoFest. This is, I think, the second annual GeoFest. This is out at the Mendenhall Visitors Center. It's sponsored by University of Alaska Fairbanks and UAS geography classes. And I guess you go out and find yourself.
find out about the world.
Don't be lost. Okay. At 1:30 p.m., there's a Native Artist Demonstration Series happening over at the Alaska State Museum. This Saturday, it will be Beatrice Knudsen. She's a Tlingit bead worker. So you can go at 1:30 and watch her and learn from her. It's free. Watercolor Landscapes class at the Canvas at 2. There's a concert of the Juno Wind Ensemble and the Thunder Mountain Wind Ensemble.
We just talked to Mike Busey about that a minute ago, so that's going to be a lot of fun. That's happening Saturday at 3 o'clock. Yeah.
It's free, all ages. There's a bouldering competition at the Rock Dump.
I beg your pardon?
Yes. That's what it says.
That's what it says.
And so
we'll
just
move on.
You can call the Rock Dump and get more information. Whatever the event is, it starts at 3 and ends at 6 with a barbecue.
Sounds like a blast.
So to speak.
A lot of climbing around. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. At 4:30, there's a tot rave at DIPAC, and this is a fundraiser for the Gold Creek Child Development Center. They said it's a fun dance for children of all ages.
And that's the child care center in the federal building, which is a nonprofit. And, it's a tot rave, a second annual tot rave. They got great. Mm-hmm. They said that it's great for the kids in DIPAC because they dance for a little while, and then they go stare at fish for a little while in the tanks.
And the fish have a good time.
And the fish have a great time, too. So that's a win-win.
It's all good. At 6 p.m. is the gala dinner auction to benefit the Oliver Inlet Tram. This is a trail mix event. There will be music by North Country Cajun, food by Abby. It's a big deal. It's at Centennial Hall. You can get tickets all over the place. So don't miss that.
Fun,
also,
always a fun event every year.
Always
yeah.
a fun and a good good thing that the trail mix does. 6:30 p.m., a Scandinavian dance at the Sons of Norway. Put that on at the Yacht Club. $10 or $5 for kids.
And potato cakes there, I think.
I don't like
them. I hope so.
It's hard to dance with them.
No, yes. Load up on potato
cakes.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
7 p.m., there's a book signing. Mary Doria Russell, Friends of the Library, is putting this on. This is the downtown library. It's free. Go there. Again, 7 p.m., Hairspray, 7:30, Oklahoma, Macbeth. That's your Saturday night for you.
Let's keep going. We got about a minute left
we
here.
We have a bunch of book signings out at Hearthside Books in the Valley. We have a matinee of Hairspray. I believe that's their last performance. And a matinee of Macbeth on Sunday. We have the invention of Hugo Cabret. It's the family movie. It's free over at the Douglas Library. James Fallows, Postcards from Tomorrow. This is the Juno World Affairs Council at the UAS Egan Lecture Hall on Sunday. That's free. Let's run down here. There's Tuesday is the anniversary of the sinking of the USS Juno. You've talked about
we
that.
We have. That's going to be a memorial service that's actually going to be over at the by the tramway.
At noon on Tuesday, Sea Alaska is doing a series of brown bag lunches, and this one will be on the origins and diversity of northern Northwest Coast headgear. It's presented by Steve Henriksen. Mud Rooms, 7 p.m. This one is Brush with Greatness. That's at Holy Trinity, 7 p.m., $7. Benefits a charity. The Native History Film Series, You Pick Way, at 7:30 out at the UAS Egan Lecture Hall. Well, we've got Amos Berg, a presentation by Vince Welch at the State Historical Library on Wednesday at noon. Also, the Southeast Master Gardeners are talking about food harvesting at the Jack at noon. My goodness, we
have
a lot of
things. There's nothing going on. Right?
There's nothing to do in Juneau. There's
All
a
right.
World Affairs Council. We have
oh,
to
what's
stop.
Happening with World Affairs Council?
Okay, that's at 5
Wrap
o'clock
up with
on
that
Wednesday.
One. Okay.
And that is, yeah, downstairs at the K2 Studios. Go onto the website and look up the entire list.
Nancy DeTourney from the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council, who is not a busy person at all. Thank you so much for coming in, Nancy. Appreciate it. And that is Arts Up, and that's a Juneau afternoon for today. A little more music here from Hairspray and then news from NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer.